Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis, it's the 14th of October 2014, and today I'm speaking with Wouter den Haan, Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics and Programme Director of CEPR's International Macroeconomics Programme. We discuss how macroeconomics has changed since the crisis and recent work from the IM programme that highlights some of these changes. We also discuss the relationship between policy and academic research and those areas in macroeconomics that are currently not researched enough. I began the interview by asking Wouter to describe, in his opinion, how macroeconomics has changed since the crisis.
Macroeconomics has changed in quite a few important dimensions. One important dimension is that we are putting an enormous amount of effort in modeling the financial sector, and in particular financial intermediaries like banks and even shadow banks. It used to be that we had financial frictions, but we're trying to be a lot more careful about what's really going on. That's very challenging, but that's one dimension. The other aspect is we used to do a lot with rational expectations, and we're still doing it, but we're now thinking about sort of self-fulfilling panics and herd behavior. So we're doing a lot more of that. And another aspect is that the research is focusing a lot more on the role of demand. So we've moved quite far away from the real business cycle model where business cycles were driven by productivity shocks.
And could you give us some examples, perhaps, from within the International Macro Program?
There's quite a few authors within the IM program that focuses on those aspects. So one paper I really like is from Pascal Michelet, who's a colleague of mine here at the LSE, and Emmanuel Saas. They're trying to build a new framework, which they hope can sort of replace the standard ISLM-type framework. And so the key observation they make is that in the goods market, you have something like unemployment too, although you may not see it. But if you're a hairdresser or you have a restaurant, is that not all your tables will be filled every evening. And so you can think of that as unemployment. So what they do, which looks a little bit like the old disequilibrium theory of the 70s, where like disequilibrium in, say, the labor market and disequilibrium in the goods market. But what they do is that they use matching friction that's been very popular in the labor market, and they apply that also to the goods market friction. And so then you can have one unified framework where you can have these notions of disequilibrium in both markets, and you can think of the interaction. So in those models, it's very natural to think about what are the consequences of demand, and demand can actually matter for what's going to happen. In terms of sort of self-fulfilling panics, there's a couple of nice papers. So I'd like to mention two. So one is by Philippe Paquetta and Eric von Winkoop. They ask the question whether if you have something bad happening in one country, can that spill over to another country? Because one thing that was peculiar about the most recent financial recession is that it hit so many countries at the same time. And that's something that we haven't quite seen before. And so what they show is that if countries become more connected, either through financial markets or through trade, then unfortunately a byproduct is that it also becomes more likely is that panics are going to carry over from one country to another. So there was this fashion that we thought globalization is good, but we may now see some of the disadvantages. And another paper where belief-driven fluctuations are very important is the work by Giancarlo Corsetti and several co-authors. So financial frictions play an important role in that paper too. So they study the interaction between sovereign default risk and premiums on sovereign debts and what happens in the private sector, and in particular what firms would have to pay if they borrow money. And so you get sort of these interesting interactions between the market for government debt and the market for private debt, and what that means for business cycles.
Do we need new approaches to macroeconomics?
Yeah, so although I mentioned that we are doing things differently in quite a few dimensions, and I think we're much more open-minded to things like multiplicity and herd behavior, we haven't changed that much. And in particular is that a lot of what we're doing is still based on rational expectations. Now, with rational expectations, you can actually do a lot more than what people think. But you can have herd behavior with rational expectations, you can have bubbles. But rational expectations, I think, restricts us still quite a bit. So I was a young student when rational expectations became popular. And the reason why rational expectations was so convincing is that before, we had expectations in our model, but it was backward looking. And so if something happened, like a different way to do monetary policy, that only had an effect in the models with a lag, because first things had to change before people updated their expectation. And we thought that's bad because people are not completely stupid. They read newspapers, so they can understand if there's a change in government policy, that it's going to change things in the future. And so rational expectation was a really nice, elegant way to model that. But we may have gone from one extreme to the other, and the truth is probably in between. But it's difficult to come up with something that's somewhat credible and workable.
Is this the sort of one of the dark places that Olivier Blanchard was speaking about?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so there are some alternatives. So agent-based modeling, it's more difficult in agent-based modeling to have the sort of this forward-looking behavior, although it's not impossible. And so, yeah, it'd be nice if there was more diversity in approaches. We're still sort of, all betting on the same horse. And that's how we build our human capital. That's what we know. And you don't want to sort of, in an ad hoc way sort of going to something else. But hopefully from lab, experiments, or other empirical work is that we get a better grip on how people actually form expectations.
Could you give us a little insight, Wouter, on what you think is the value and the relationship between academic research and policy, perhaps?
I think we've come a lot closer. I mean, before the crisis is that we sort of had the freedom to do what we wanted because, the economy was doing quite well. It wasn't that bad to live in the ivory tower. But because of the crisis is that, policymakers, they needed answers and they needed sort of, frameworks to start thinking about, new questions. I think, quite a few of us have stepped up to the plate. So Ricardo Reis, who was also in the IM program, has written, quite a few papers about sort of, the institutions of the central bank and what does it mean if a central bank's balance sheet is getting, bigger? Is that, can it grow without bound, which some people think. Giancarlo Corsetti and Luca Dodola, they asked the question of whether it's really true, is that if a country has an independent monetary policy like the UK, is it really true that then debt is less problematic because the government could always inflate the debt away? But also in terms of quantitative easing, we need new frameworks, or actually we went back to old frameworks to think about what quantitative meaning meant. And I think it's a very positive development, is it that we as researchers now ask ourselves, is it not useful to answer currently important questions? Much more so than we did in the past, although I'm sure we could do still quite a bit more.
And what would you say are the weak points currently in macroeconomic research?
I think one weakness is what I mentioned earlier, is expectations. Rational expectations means that things in our model respond very quickly to changes. For example, the models that have been built to understand the behavior at the zero lower bound, expectations are crucially important, and results can be incredibly sensitive. So whether you assume that you get out of the zero lower bound with some probability, or you assume is that you're going to get out of the lower bound with some probability, but you get out for sure in 5 years, the results can be completely different. And that's because of rational expectations. People are really forward-looking, they take everything into account, and it's just not credible. Right? There's so small changes in how you model getting out of the zero lower bound could have such a big impact. Understanding how people really do the forward-looking, how they respond to sort of changes, is that's still something we don't understand very well. And the other thing is sort of like the holy grail now, is just endogenous risk. In most models, where we do put in frictions in financial markets, risk goes up if times are bad. Firms have less net worth, so frictions in getting financing are more important. But what apparently has happened during the last recession and probably during other financial crises, risk was actually building up in good times. And that's not happening in most of our models. In our models is that in good times, firms are getting richer, they can finance more investment by themselves. It'd be nice if we can understand that better. And this could be something behavioral, that people become more sure of themselves if they haven't seen a recession for a while, but we're not quite there in terms of modeling that in a satisfactory way.
And is this related to the whole issue of deleveraging?
It's sort of the two parts. First is that during in the good times were people, you know, taking on more leverage because they were confident, because they somehow didn't see that risk. And then, of course, when you're hit, then you got to deleverage. And we actually have quite a few models now that make us understand why deleveraging is bad, right? Through what kind of channels necessary deleveraging can be bad for the economy. But we don't quite understand why it builds up and why people don't realize that there is this risk.
So finally, Walter, what areas in macroeconomics do you think are not researched enough?
It's very fashionable to study financial crises and financial sectors and financial intermediation and frictions, and that's probably a good thing. But the joke is always is that macroeconomists, they study the last recession and then they forget about the next one. And I'm actually quite worried about that, because before the financial crisis, we actually did think that there was going to be a crisis. But that was the crisis related to the baby boomers and global imbalances. Now, actually, is it that we stopped worrying about that a little bit before the financial crisis. 9/11 actually was important, too. Before 9/11, even politicians worried about baby boomers and what that was going to mean in terms of financial obligations, in terms of healthcare and pensions. And then 9/11 is that politicians stopped worrying about it. And then when the financial crisis hit, macroeconomists stopped worrying about it. But the baby boomer problem hasn't gone away. And so that could be the next crisis that's going to hit us. But we are very busy understanding the financial crisis.
Walter den Haan, thanks ever so much for taking the time to talk to us today.